So for those of you who are here in the hall and at home, this Sunday is part of an ongoing retreat that began Thursday night and will continue to Monday morning. For those of you who've never been on retreat, very helpful to be able to, because for many of us, and as we are lay people, we lead busy lives, active lives, and even in our meditation and our learning and transformation, it's hard to really focus on it because of, you know, we just get lost in all the activity of our life. So to be able to truly put it all down and just focus on nurturing ourselves with meditation and with the Dharma is very beneficial. So heartily recommend it to people. You know, I mean, very simply, in retreat, we're learning how to live, you see. How to live fully as a human being. How to have a mind that really supports us. And how to have the capacity to really going back into life with openness and understanding, greater capacity for kindness, selflessness, etc. So that's what retreat's about. We're able to focus very directly on aspects of the Dharma that nourish us. So the focus for this retreat, again, which began Thursday night, and both has people here in residence, about 20 people and about 40 people online, are these 14 verses on meditation by Thich Nhat Hanh. As you know, he left us, so to speak, in his physical body approximately 7 weeks ago. And in the Buddhist tradition, the rituals around death and dying, usually the mourning period is usually a mourning period of 7 weeks. So we wanted to honor, I'm sure in the Thich Nhat Hanh monasteries and centers, they do various kinds of rituals and things to acknowledge that. So I wanted to do something here on our retreat. And so these 14 verses, while they're in the Plum Village chanting book, are really not taught. I just discovered them by accident myself, as people, I've told people here 4 or 5 years ago in the Plum Village chanting book, having passed it probably over many times. One time I just saw 14 verses on meditation. I stopped and I went, oh, this is quite special. Because while Thich Nhat Hanh has obviously great fame and notoriety for his capacity to meet us where we're at and generate all kinds of teachings and practices that make the Dharma very accessible and meaningful, there also is a deeper side of him as a Zen master. And so I was struck by these 14 verses on meditation. And I'll just say what I said to people on retreat. I did, when I discovered them and had never heard about them or seen them ever taught, I inquired of a number of the senior monastics in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. And they, you know, maybe it's changed, but this was several years ago. They didn't know when and where he had written, but they've been obviously part of the tradition. So they're quite wonderful and deep. There are 14 of them. And basically, in the last 2.5 days, I've been able to comment on only the first 4. And really, each one of them deserves attention. So I will just quickly read through. And for those who are on retreat, it'll be a little kind of, a summary a little bit and a reminder of what we've been through. And then focus today on verse 7. Again, there's a lot packed into them. So just listen. So the first verse says, just as a bird has two wings, the practice of meditation has stopping and deep looking. The two wings depend on each other. Stopping and deep looking go in tandem. So again here, Thay Nhat Hanh, I'll just call him Thay, which means teacher, what he's referred to, has kind of put forward his which is, again, traditional Buddhism, his statement of what Buddhist meditation is about. It's about stopping and deep looking. They go together. We don't do just one and not the other. They depend on each other. They enrich each other. And you know, they are the path of our development in life. Verse 2, stopping means to be still in order to recognize, to be in contact, to nourish, to heal, to calm, to soothe, and to focus the mind. So again, this is very key to his really whole path, which is, and especially as it applies to people like us, we are lay people, the first thing we need to do is stop, right? Stop the endless busyness, stop the endless activity, both externally and most importantly, internally, right? We need to stop, to come back to ourselves, right? Why? So we can recognize, be in contact with what's going on within us and around us in a very direct way. Because in our busyness and our activity of body and mind, we are not attentive to what is going on truly within us and around us, right? So we need to stop so we can recognize inwardly and outwardly. We can be in contact with whatever is arising outwardly and inwardly. So we can take the time to take care of things that need to be taken care of, right? Which means within ourselves and with around us, people around us, in our relationships, in our work. You know, we're busy, 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 but we don't stop to be in contact with the human beings in our life or our world even. So when we stop, then we have the opportunity to nourish, to heal, to calm, to soothe, and to learn how to focus the mind, okay? So that's stopping. Deep looking means to regard in depth the true nature of the five skandhas so that understanding may arise to transform all sadness and pain. So I'm not gonna give a talk about the five skandhas today. But basically, what he's talking about really is we need to look deeply when we stop. And after we've done all this other stuff that we're in the second verse, the real purpose of Buddhist meditation is to look deeply into life. Look deeply into reality, so we can understand what's really going on, right? This is really the ultimate purpose, one might say, of meditation. Because usually we're just dealing with things surface level. We're reactive to ourselves, to others, we're going from crisis to crisis, situation to situation, emotional reactivity to emotional reactivity. We're just kind of taking care of things. But we want to look deeply, especially we want to look deeply when the five skandhas are really sort of really about the nature of self, the nature of I, me, my, the nature of ego. What is this thing? Right? The nature of thoughts. What is the thought? Where do they come from? You see what I'm saying? The nature of reality. Is it solid? Is it permanent? Things, right? So this looking deeply into is produces insight, produces wisdom, produces understanding. And as he says, it is through this that we can transform all sadness and pain. And now the next two verses have to do with, again, coming back to this stopping. So he says, the breath and the footsteps generate the source of mindfulness, which then enables one to recognize to be in touch with the wonders of life. So here he's getting a little more specific and very much about his dharma, you know, great emphasis on full awareness, mindfulness of the breath, and mindfulness, walking meditation. He loved walking meditation. And so we have to learn to generate the mind that's aware, the mind that's present, right? And so he's giving us now the practices, right, of mindful awareness of the breath, body breath, full awareness of the, you know, of the body as it walks, as ways that we can learn to generate this energy, which is the opposite energy of the energy of dispersion, of scatteredness, right? It's the energy that is aware and focused, right? So again, so we can be in touch with the wonders of life. And as I said to people on retreat, this is not wonders with a capital W. People go, whew, where are the wonders, you know? It's like the wonders of just being here. Like somehow this is kind of wonderful. The wonderful of everything we do, all our encounters, the wonder of just life. Right, yesterday I gave the participants in retreat, you know, usually we do walking meditation like we do this morning, you know, in a formal way. And I said, what I want you to do now is just, we're going to go outside. And I want you just to walk, but I want you to walk in a very special way. And very briefly, I told them how Thay used to use the analogy of somebody who'd been in a spaceship for years in a kind of very sensory deprived environment, and they came back to Earth. The cabin opens. What that would be like, the wonderment of being back, you know, in a full kaleidoscope of experience. You know, walk like that, which is sort of like walking like a child, totally fresh, no ideas about anything, no labeling, no naming, just totally present with a kind of empty mind. And, so I sent people out to do that. And there was one gentleman who's on retreat, you know, who leads a very busy life as a professional. And he shared, you know, at some point I just stopped and I looked up and I just watched the bamboo swaying in the breeze and the light coming through it. And he said, you know, he said, all of a sudden I felt like I was high, you know, like in an alternative reality. I was high and I just had this feeling of happiness. That's what we're talking about. We stop and we notice the simple wonders of life. The breath, the footstep generate the source of mindfulness, able one to recognize, to be in touch with the wonders of life, to calm, to relax body and mind, to nourish, to heal, to protect the six senses, maintain right concentration. So that's an elaboration on, you know, the purpose of this stopping. Let me just say, these 14 verses, if you go to our website and just in the search thing, just type in 14 verses so everybody can have access to them. For those who aren't on retreat, people on retreat have been given copies. So I'll just, you know, going to go through what we've taught so far. But you can see there's a lot packed into them, what these things really mean and how you practice them. That's what we're doing on retreat. And then the last verse that we did on retreat yesterday, and again, during retreat, it has been alternating throughout the day, teaching, on a very specific verse, commenting on it, talking about how to practice it, and then practicing with it. Either people directly practicing on it, practicing it through guided meditations, And then there's been time for people to ask questions. So there's a process that we do to make sure that people are really learning and experiencing the fruits of the practice. So the sixth one deals now with the second, the deep looking. Looking deeply into reality to see the true nature of all dharmas, meditation helps us to let go of all seeking, wishing, and fears. So again, up above in verse 3, he said deep looking, the purpose is so understanding may arise to transform all sadness and pain, which really means all affliction. Right now, he says, looking deeply into reality to see the true nature of things. The word dharma here is a small d dharma. It really means everything. Dharmas are things. There are physical things and mental things, but it really means all, the whole, all of this. all the world that is experienced by the six senses and the mind. We are always experiencing dharmas, right? And we maybe aren't seeing them correctly, right? We are maybe being fooled by how things appear to us, just like in a dream, right? When we're in a dream, we're fooled, aren't we? Because we, in the dream, we think it's real, right? It's funny, last night I dreamt, what did I dream? It was a strange kind of dream because I was there, somehow when I was aware that my mother had died, and all of a sudden I said to Angie, oh, mother's not there anymore. You know, dad's alone now. He lives alone. There's probably nobody, you know, taking care of him. You know, we better go check up on him, right? And all of a sudden in the dream, there was confusion. It's like, what's, you know? Because actually my father died 22 years before my mother. So, but can you see in that moment, the dream appeared real to me, didn't it? And yet, when I was willing to kind of look more deeply into it, and that confusion, even in the dream, kind of woke me up. I woke up and I realized it was just a dream. It wasn't real. And so this is very key to Buddhist understanding, that the way we perceive reality, the way we experience reality, the feelings that arise from that may be misperceived, misguided. And it is that which is calling. I mean, here he says, the way up above, he said, to transform all sadness and pain. And here he says, so we can let go of all seeking, wishing, and fears. And again, I talked a lot about that. It doesn't mean that, you're like a stone, it's like you don't do anything. It's much deeper than that. It really means that rather than coming from a place of inadequacy, rather than coming from a place always like there's something missing in me, something missing in others, something missing in life, you know. So we're always what? To fill up that place of dissatisfaction or that place of emptiness or that place of things aren't right, we're always seeking things, right? Either in things, in experiences, in relationships, always seeking outwardly to fill up the hole that's inside us. We're always wishing for something, wishing for things to be different, right? And of course, fears, right? We're afraid something is going to happen or afraid something's not going to happen. But either way, and all these things are all, as you see, are all future-based. And they come from a place of not feeling whole and complete in the present. When one sees into the reality of life and understands the reality of life, perhaps saying the dreamlike quality of life, when one wakes up to that, that's called awakening. And we awaken, we can awaken all the time. Last night I awoke from a dream that in the dream I thought was real. So we want to be able to wake up so we can be free and stop this endless needing and wanting and seeking. Why? So we can be at peace. So we can be happy with what's going on right now. And we can learn, this is the place that I need to be transformed. So, anyhow, that's a little summary of these first six verses that we have been focusing on since Thursday night. And today is Sunday. Our retreat goes through to tomorrow early afternoon. So verse 7 reads, to dwell in the present moment, to transform all habit energies, to give rise to understanding, liberating ourselves from all afflictions. So you can see in Thay Nhat Hanh's Thay's verses on meditation, he's not talking about psychological, emotional remediation, like a lessening of, right? A lessening of our fears, anxieties, a lessening of our angers. You see, you know what I mean? Which is really, I think for many of us, we'd be willing to settle for that, right? But he's really coming really to the heart of the Buddha's message. Because he says, liberating ourselves from all afflictions. Up above, he said, to transform all sadnesses and pain. Again, I think for modern people, this is hard for us, you see, because we are so used to believing, even from childhood, that to be in the world of emotional afflictions is normal. And the purpose of spirituality or religion or therapy is to kind of make it more manageable, right? Make it more manageable. And again, certainly that's better than, having our emotions always be disturbing us, disturbing our relationships. But the idea of being free from emotional afflictions, having a mind in which emotional afflictions don't arise, or when, that's a fully enlightened being, but, arise and don't disturb. Don't disturb the essential calmness of the mind. Don't disturb the actions of our body and our speech. This of us, we may hear the words, but I think it's hard for us to believe that that's really what's being told to us in this path. From the Buddha and his own enlightenment and what he taught 2,600 years ago to really all the masters. They're all saying the same thing. And here's Thich Nhat Hanh saying the same thing 2,600 years later. So, the first section says, Again, the last one says liberating ourselves from all afflictions, but the first says to dwell in the present moment. Step one. Right? This is a developmental path. Step one. And that really comes back to stopping. Right? We stop. So we can see wherever we've been, wandering in the past, wandering in the future, wandering in some kind of emotional drama, right? We can stop. We can see, where am I right now? Right? And that stopping and being in the present moment allows us to be present to what we're experiencing, even if it's an emotional affliction or drama, and to recognize it for what it is. Right? Usually there is no stopping, there's no recognition. So we are what? We're just swept away. Lost in thought, lost in emotionality, lost in drama. Right? But for those who are learning to live in the present moment, which means stopping and noticing there's a present moment, right? See, most of us don't realize this is a present moment, right? Whatever is happening right now is a present moment. This is a present moment. What's happening right now within me and around me? That's the stopping. And it is only when we stop that all these other benefits can begin to flow. So this is why present moment awareness, when I'm walking, I'm just walking. When I'm looking, I'm just looking. When I'm smelling, I'm just smelling, right? Is so essential to this path, because that's how we train ourselves to be present. It's easier to do it with the body, right? Body, breath, walking, because it's a physical sensation. So it's, in a certain way, it's easier for us to get a handle on it, right? And the wonderful thing about sensory experience, it's always happening right now, right? I mean, you're not walking in the past, you're not walking in the future, you're walking right now. The ground that we step on is right here, okay? What we're seeing, what we're smelling, so the physical world is always a present moment world. So learning to be present to our physical environment, our sensory environment, is easiest for us to access. Okay? Now, obviously the problem is often, usually, where? In our minds, right? But it's that grounding ourselves and noticing there's a present moment and noticing the physicality of our experience gives us the opportunity of then looking at our minds, heart, mind, and recognizing what's going on and naming it. See, now there's some distance and some objectivity. We can be observers of our experience, and in that observation, again, depending on the energy of our mindfulness, we can then, what? Second, transform all habit energies. Okay? So he's giving us kind of our homework, you see, and really clarifying to us what this path is about. So again, often people think, oh, I practice Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching. Yeah, when I drink tea, I just drink tea. When I brush my teeth, I just brush my teeth. Mm-mm. That's the entryway. That's how we learn to be mindful and how to be present, right? That's all good stuff. But the purpose of that really is to transform all habit energies. I mean, you could be a miserable, unhappy human being and be aware that you're drinking your tea. And be fully present to drinking your tea and fully present to, you know. You see what I'm saying? I mean, so there is it. Well, yeah, I think you understand what I'm saying, right? So again, one can practice the mindfulness of one's present moment physicality and get benefit from, but in terms of really for those who want to transform themselves, who want to be free of their suffering, who want to really facilitate the opening of their heart and their freedom from self and the imprisonment of self and self-consciousness and issues and all that. That's what we want to transform. That's the purpose. So we don't, you know, that's why as part of in our community, as part of our first path, you know, we have these three paths of practice. Our first path is the path of mindful living, which includes mindfulness, body, speech, and mind, four awarenesses, and as well as healing, emotional healing. So we need to be able to very objectively be present to our afflictions, to our sufferings, to these habit energies. Habit energy implies what? That they have a history. They're not arising because we're bad people. They're arising because, you know, of that we've turned a way of being in the world into a habit, right? And the idea behind a habit, it's habitual. We don't have to think about it, right? It's not conscious. And we have good habits and we have bad habits, right? And we want to learn to strengthen our good habits, our wholesome habits, right? And we want to learn what? To transform, not to suppress, not to repress, not to eradicate, right? But to transform. Transform means you take something, you begin with the thing itself, and you change it into something else, right? So we begin by being present to this habit energy, this energy, this mind state, this emotional state, right? That when we look at it objectively, say, this does not serve me well. It causes my mind to be agitated. It causes my heart to be heavy. It causes me to close down. It causes me to wall off. It causes me to act out, you know, all kinds of things. Right? So that's a very personal decision. Of course, it's often reinforced by people we live in who kind of give us feedback that, you know, some things better change, which is helpful because we're often blind to ourselves, not in touch with ourselves. So this capacity, you see, to dwell in the present moment and to be objective, very hard for people because we don't, some of us, what we, you know, there are things we experience inside when we're really present to our mind states, our thoughts, our feelings, we don't like it. You know, we don't like that part of ourselves. We don't want to acknowledge that. Or it's painful, right? It brings up stuff that's painful. And we don't like to be in pain, right? So this capacity of present moment awareness is very powerful, you see? And we use it for our healing, okay? So it's, and again, we wanna ultimately transform. You know, we might say a Buddha, a fully enlightened person, a Bodhisattva is somebody who has transformed all their negative habit energies. And that may go, wow. Impossible to think somebody's done that. But of course you can. Because you weren't born with habit energies, right? All your habit energies you've been working on for however old you are, right? That's how they become habits. And anything that wasn't there but was constructed through life can be deconstructed, right? Kind of logical? I mean, it's not, people think, ooh, that's just the way I am, you see. No, it's not the way we are, it's the way we become, the way our causes and conditions have unfolded in this life. And we, not knowing better, just continue to, you know, like anything that becomes a habit, things become a habit because of why? Repetition, repetition, repetition. We always think in a certain way, or we always react in a certain way, or we always interpret things in a certain way, or we always judge things in a way, or we always assess things in a certain way, right? And over time, we don't have to kind of consciously do it anymore, right? It's a habit, you see. And again, the problem is because habits are ingrained in our body mind at this point that they are not conscious. In other words, we're not consciously bringing them forward. Is that clear? They're a habit. So it's very hard for us to see, you know, unless it's very obvious, you know? Like if we have a habit of eating junk food, right? And we know, it's not good for me. You see, whatever it is, you can see physically, you know, oh, here I go again, right? Going down that aisle once again in Publix, you know what I mean? Reaching, putting in the bag, you know, it's very clear. So it's easier to catch ourselves, right? When we want to change overt habits. But habits of mind are much subtler because they seem so normal to us. You see, they think this is just the way we are. And so again, sometimes life, other people, you know, point things out to us. But often we don't like that, do we? No, we don't like that. We're not good listeners when people are doing that because we don't want to hear it, do we? We don't want to stop and go, is there some truth in that? Maybe they see something that I don't see, right? Everybody in this room, everybody online, do we not see things in others that they don't see? Right? You see, it's very easy for us to be objective about other people and see their stuff, right? Is that true? Just reflect for a moment. We do it all the time, don't we? And yet, are we really as objective and clear about seeing our own stuff? Think about that. It's hard. That's what mindfulness is about, you see. I can objectively be aware of what's going on. I can be objectively aware about my patterns of speech and see how the world is reacting to it. You know, all kinds of things with mindfulness. But most importantly, this is where the Dharma teaching is so helpful, we're learning criteria that we may not have to go, that's not healthy. No. Because we grew up in families and in societies, and we think it's all normal, you see. And then all of a sudden, and then you go through the list in the Abhidhamma, there's a list of 51 mind states, you know, wholesome and unwholesome. And you go, uh-oh, that's in the afflictive mind state. So we have criteria now. Right? If we don't have our own criteria that really goes, yeah, when I go down that road emotionally, speech, thought, it causes me suffering. It causes me to get agitated. I lose my well-being. I lose my open-heartedness. See, if we don't have that, then we have this other kind of criteria where we can kind of make a self-assessment, so to speak, you know, and go, yeah, that's not good habit energy. So there are lots of habits of body, speech, and mind that we want to transform. And we do that, as he says, to transform all, to dwell in the present moment, to transform all habit energies. Next one is to give rise to understanding. Okay. So again, this is very important that we understand that in the Buddhist teaching, it is understanding that liberates us. Mindfulness alone will not liberate us. That is why the Buddha just didn't teach calming and stopping, right? He taught also deep looking, which produces understanding. It is understanding that liberates us, because understanding gets at causation. You see, mindfulness just might reveal what is, right? So if you stop and you're present and you're, you know, very able to objectively see yourself, and you see, let's say, I have a lot of anger in me, resentment, it's really very present in my mind, or I have a lot of worry and anxiety, or I have a lot of sadness, or I have a lot of, you know, all kinds of things, right? And by, you know, kind of, you know, introspecting a little bit, we say, oh, I can see why. I understand my childhood. I understand the things I've been exposed to in this life and the things that have conditioned me, right? Does that change it? Does that transform it? So it is really a deep understanding of things, where we understand fully, not just that something is present in me, but I understand fully it doesn't have to be. I wasn't born with that. If I understand fully, it is a trait that doesn't serve me, and it doesn't serve my relationships. And if I understand how I can transform it, right? Understanding produces that. So that is why, remember in the beginning, stopping and deep looking, they're two birds, the wings. They go in tandem. They depend on each other. Understanding depends on stopping, but understanding can't happen without stopping. So again, you know, a bird with one wing doesn't fly too far. And if our practice only has one side, in this case, for most people, the stopping side, but doesn't have the wisdom side, the deep looking side, our transformation will not really occur. And what Thay is, you know, after Thay's passing, one of the messages that went out is, you know, everyone who wants to be, who looks to him as a teacher, whether you had personal contact with him or through his books or videos or whatever, or you went to a retreat. People said, yeah, how can I be his continuation? He was he was an example to me. His teachings really moved me. So how can we be his continuation? To continue, his physical form has left us, as all physical forms leave. But in a certain way, it was through Thich Nhat Hanh, as one of many, fortunately, who through his deep practice was able to keep alive the continuation of Shakyamuni Buddha, right? Shakyamuni Buddha, you know, left his physical form 2,600 years ago. What is the connection of the Buddha, right? 2,600 years ago plus in northern India, and Thay Nhat Hanh, Vietnam, coming to the West, etc. What's the connection? Generation after generation of people who practice the Buddha's teachings so they could continue it. And so now Thich Nhat Hanh has passed, right? And so do we want to be his continuation? We become his continuation by practicing his Dharma. See, like these 14 verses, again, I don't know exactly why and when he did it. Maybe we'll find out at some point. But why did he write these down? Right? I mean, he knew them. Right? This is the way he practiced. This is his meditation practice. Why did he write it down? For us. So we could continue the transmission of this Dharma, of this deep Dharma, right? To keep it alive in the world. But we don't keep it alive in the world by reading his books. I mean, he said that over and over again. You know, we don't continue it by reading his books. There's nothing wrong with reading his books. There's nothing wrong with studying the Dharma. But if the Dharma is just continued in books, in videos, it'll be a dead Dharma. It won't be a live Dharma. To be alive, it has to enter into the consciousness, the activity of body, speech, and mind of human beings, right? And it becomes alive. So to dwell in the present moment, to transform all habit energies, to give rise to understanding. Out of that comes understanding. And then the last one is liberating ourselves from all afflictions. This is very important. Again, I said something about this in the beginning. The problem is there'll be people listening to this talk and go, what? That's overwhelming. That's impossible to liberate myself all afflictions, especially if you've taken an inventory of your afflictions. Recently, you might go, wow, I mean, that's impossible. So Thich Nhat Hanh gave us a very good teaching about liberation. Because many of us can read Buddhist texts and we see liberation with a capital L, which makes us think there's one big liberation, right? And either you think, I'm gonna go get that sucker, or too big for me, you see? But Thay had a very interesting way of putting it. He said, liberation occurs each moment. Okay? So you may have 1,000 afflictions, right? If you start categorizing them. Probably not, but let's say if there are 51 positive and negative, maybe you have 20 or 25 major afflictions, right? Much more doable. They only arise one at a time. Right? They only arise one at a time. In a moment of anger, in a moment of fear, in a moment of despair, in a moment of jealousy, in a moment of greed, in a moment of, you know, yearning, and seeking. You see, I mean, each of those things are arising in a moment of experience, right? I mean, they don't arise all together, right? So, if we have present moment awareness, if we have the capacity of stopping, if we have the ability to recognize, right, that an affliction has arisen in me, it's present in me when? Right now. Okay? This is key to the process. This is key to the kingdom, right? An affliction has arisen right now. A negative mind state has arisen right now. You see? In that moment, Tai would say, this is the moment to liberate ourselves from that. And that's doable. See, that's doable. To liberate ourselves from all afflictions, but we have to take Tai's word or the Buddha's word that it is possible to do that over time. Is that clear? In the traditional Buddhist teaching, a Buddha's been at this for a lifetime to really rid ourselves of all afflictions. But to rid ourselves of one affliction at a time, as they arise in the present, right? You know, another way to put it is, you know, in modern way we talk, you know, we get stuck, don't we? We get stuck. We get stuck in a mind state. We get stuck in a pattern of thinking. We get, you know, we get stuck in things. We get stuck in relationships, you know, we get stuck in you know what I mean? Is that a good word? You see, it's like we freeze. We get stuck. We get stuck in a loop of anger. We get stuck in a loop of fear. We get stuck in a loop of despair. You see, it's just circling around. We're stuck. Does that, everybody know, does that kind of feel like something we know? We get stuck. We get stuck. How do I, in this moment, get myself unstuck? How do I free myself? In this moment, I'm kind of trapped by my habit energies, trapped by my conditioning. You know, you can use all kinds of words, right? But if you're aware and you have criteria and you know you're stuck in something you don't want to be stuck in, right? We can free ourselves, can't we? You see, it's, and all of a sudden just came into my mind, you know, like those bear traps, you see, you know, that's what we think, you see, it's like that, you know what I mean, and you can't even pull it apart, you see, but no, we're not, that's not what we're stuck in, but we're stuck in some kind of, what, some kind of trap made of balsa wood. Or wood or something, you know, we're trapped, but it's not the bear claw, right? Don't think it's the bear claw. Those movies, you know, where these guys step into the thing. It's not that, you see. Oftentimes we think it's that. No, we stop. We're aware of a feeling state, of a mind state. And our mindfulness holds it and gives it space. Breathing in, I'm aware that anger has arisen in me. Breathing in, I'm aware that fear, anxiety, you know, sadness, despair, jealousy, lust, greed, you know, you see? I'm aware of that. And I give it space. I hold it in mindfulness. Give it space. You see, that's See, there's no bear trap. If we think there's a bear trap, there'll be a bear trap. If we think we're stuck in some kind of a movable thing, we'll be stuck in it. You know, mind is very open and spacious, but it gets stuck. Another word could be it fixates. You know, maybe that's a good word. You know how we just get fixed on something? Keep just spinning around, fixing over and over. So we gotta unfixate ourselves, right? You know, all kinds of word, fixation, rumination. You know, we just ruminate over and over. Okay. So again, meditation is learning how to work with our minds. That's what we're learning. We're learning about the mind and how the mind operates, and we're learning how it, you know, how to help it become more wholesome. We're learning how to get it unstuck. We're learning how to transform it. Right? Yeah. So that's number 7, to dwell in the present moment, to transform all habit energies, to give rise to understanding, liberating ourselves from all afflictions. So those who have not been on retreat with us these last 3 days can understand why it's taken us this long just to get halfway through. And again, I actually felt like I was going too fast. So there's so much here, as you can see. So let me just stop. Any questions just about, practice of this, implications of this, okay? If you're online, just chat them in to, and Angie will recognize you. Anybody in the hall, just raise your hand and I will call on you, Juan.
So my question.
Is it on? What we found is sometimes people, you know, they're used to talking and moving. And so then it's really for people online, okay?
So my question is, if I understand correctly, you're saying that mindfulness is just like standing guard, essentially, for everything that passes through our mind, good or bad, and just letting those unwholesome things not through? And if so, how do we watch our mind while we sleep?
Let me deal with the first part, Juan. Okay. So Juan's in the military, so he talks about guard duty, right? Yeah. So that's a good analogy, right? And actually, Shanti Davis said that. We need a gatekeeper. Shanti Davis, 8th century India. Yeah. So that's another way of saying it. You know, that's our problem. We don't have a gatekeeper. There's nobody on guard. So, right? Anything can get in. Anything can leave, right? I mean, there's nobody, you know, there's nobody at the gate of our mind. Right? So mindfulness is planting that gatekeeper, right? And that gatekeeper has two functions. Have you ever been a guard? What? You've been a guard? You've been a guard? Okay. So you have two functions. One is to stop everybody, right? To watch who's coming and going. But then to identify, right? Are they allowed or not allowed? Okay, you see there's two functions there. And this really encapsulates mindfulness. So mindfulness, we are aware of what's arising in our mind. But secondly, we have criteria. We know what's wholesome and unwholesome. We know, oh, this is welcome. Come on in, enjoy yourself. This is a troublemaker. Just gonna stir things up, right? Okay. So that's a good analogy, and that's a good analogy for mindfulness. Let's talk about sleep another time. Okay. Myself, I have enough trouble just practicing during the day. You know? but actually, as you probably know, there are practices in the yogic tradition about dream states and things. Any other questions? In the hall or online? Angie? Yes.
Online, there's the question. How do you work with the habit energy if the thoughts present themselves as a kind of interlocking obsessions? I found it very
interlocking obsessions.
Obsessions. I have found it very difficult to slow this down, to slow this habit pattern down.
Yeah, so that's a good question, right? So habit. Some habits are not that strong. Right? Anybody in this room, anybody online ever change a habit? Right? We've all changed habits. Right? Some habits are easier to change than others. Have you noticed that? Now that's for various reasons. One reason is maybe it isn't that strong, right? It isn't that intense, right? It doesn't have as much history to it. But also a habit that doesn't have a lot of energy behind it are easier to change, yeah. But a habit that we've been doing a long time and that has a lot of energy around it, you see, we've really, is harder, okay? So let's acknowledge that. I'm just acknowledging that. And yet we look at it and we go, it's not serving me well. So it's really what we're just talking about with Juan, okay? Very important. If you're guarding the post, are you stationed outside the post or are you stationed somewhere right in the middle of the post? Well, no, you're outside it. I mean, you're at the entrance gate. That's what I meant. I'm sorry. You're not like a mile into the right, because if you were a mile into it, you wouldn't encounter the person until what? They've been in for a while, and they could have been running amok somewhere else, right? And you wouldn't know it because you're okay. So this is very important. We have to post our mindfulness at the gate of our mind. And get better at, this is very important, identifying when it first enters. Okay? Usually it doesn't enter in a two-ton truck roaring at 80 miles an hour. Now, not to say that it sometimes might, but it appear that way. But for most of us, there is a buildup. But that buildup is going on unconsciously. We're not conscious of it. So there's a pattern that's beginning, right? A pattern that's beginning, a thought, a perception, a way of looking at things, you see? Do we stop? Are we able to identify it at that level? My guess, no. We're not that attuned to it. We haven't watched it enough to see it doesn't come on full blown. There's a process, very subtle. And we're not aware of it because we're not conscious of it because it seems so, we're so used to it. It happens unconscious. It's a habit, you see. So we have to get better and better at catching it earlier on, identifying it earlier on. Not when it's full blown. Let's take anger. Anybody have an issue with anger? That's one of their bad habits. Okay, so I would imagine if you watch it, and I'm sure you have, you will see it begins, somebody does something, somebody doesn't do something, right? And first there is a thought, and we're not even conscious, that says what? I don't like what's happening, right? A little irritated, right? And then we repeat it again. I can't believe they did that. A little more irritated. Well, they're really insensitive. Bump. Watch it, you'll see. Anxiety is the same thing. Begins with a very little perception. Something happens. We think about it. And it begins to feed on itself. And again, unfortunately, our internal radar, our mindfulness, doesn't notice till when. Yeah, full blown, you see? Right? And that's like, it's like if the guard is in the middle of the base, right, and already people are all over the place, you have a problem, don't you? You have a big problem, you see? More energy is going to take to deal with this problem because they're all over the place. But if you had caught them at the entranceway, it wouldn't be that big a problem, would it? You see? And that's, so thank you, Juan, for the analogy. But that's really what's happening within our own minds, you see. And that's why we often feel, whew, this is big. What do I do? You know? Well, when it's at that obsessive, emotionally intense level, yeah, it's like, you know, there's sometimes not much we can do other than kind of ride it out, right? Try not to act out, you know, sort of control the response a bit. But we got to get better at our mindfulness. Catch it early on. Set that gatekeeper at the gate, give her criteria. This is who you let in. If you see this one, don't let her in. Deal with her at the gate. And it's easier. So good. So for those of you who aren't on retreat, it gives you a little sense of what goes on here. Those who are on retreat, this ends the talk, and we will be having lunch in 15 minutes. Usually we have a live tea here for people after, but because of retreat, there won't be live tea. And for people who are not part of retreat, if you could leave in silence because of people in retreat, it's a silent retreat. So we're not talking to each other. Unfortunately, I have to talk, but so be it. So thank you, everyone.